Section 8, A Survey of Buddhism. A Survey of Buddhism was written between the end of 1954 and the beginning of 1956 on the basis of lectures delivered in Bangalore in the summer of 1954 and was published in 1957. It is sometimes referred to as my magnum opus, and such indeed it is in the sense that it is the most comprehensive and systematic of all my writings on Buddhism. It is, however, quite an early work. When I gave the lectures on which it is based, I had been a Buddhist for 13 years and a monk for 5, and, as I wrote in the preface to the 5th edition of the survey, the giving of the lectures and the subsequent preparation of them for publication in book form gave me the opportunity of standing back and taking a look at the great spiritual tradition to which I had committed myself, and of trying to sum up, for my own benefit as much as for that of other people, what I had learned about Buddhism in the course of my 13 years as a Buddhist, and how, at the end of that time, I saw the Buddha's teaching. It gave me the opportunity, in other words, of finding out what I really thought of Buddhism, what Buddhism really meant to me. End of quote. More than 30 years have passed. I have now been a Buddhist, not for 13 years, but for 47. And it would be strange if today I saw the Buddha's teaching in exactly the same way as I saw it then. It would be strange if there had been no change, or rather no development, in my thinking about Buddhism. Strange if Buddhism did not mean even more to me now than it did when I wrote the survey. This is not to say that I have found anything wrong with the fundamental principles on which the book is based, or any reason to change my approach to Buddhism, or my method of treatment, even though the work admittedly has its limitations, limitations which I have tried to make good in some of my subsequent writings and lectures. Such changes as have taken place in my thinking about Buddhism during the last 30 years have taken place entirely as a result of the further application of some of the principles enunciated in the survey itself. As I have explained in my preface to the 5th edition, in taking my look at Buddhism, I was concerned principally to do two things. I was concerned to see Buddhism in its full breadth and in its ultimate depth, by which I meant that I was concerned firstly to see Buddhism as a whole, and secondly to see it in its deeper interconnections, both within itself and in relation to the spiritual life of the individual Buddhist. Seeing Buddhism as a whole meant doing justice to all its principal teachings and major historical forms, as well as showing that these were interconnected by virtue of their common basic principles and their bearing on the spiritual life of the individual. Seeing it in its depth meant trying to understand why the Buddha had taught this or that doctrine, or what relation it had to the needs of the individual as he wrestled with the problems of existence. Breadth and depth were, however, inseparable. As the years went by, I increasingly found that the more I related Buddhism to the spiritual life of the individual Buddhist, the more I saw it in its deeper interconnections within itself, and the more I saw it in its deeper interconnections within itself, the more I saw it not as a collection of miscellaneous parts, but as an organic whole. This was nowhere more apparent than in the case of going for refuge, which I eventually came to see as the central and definitive act of the Buddhist life, and as the unifying principle, therefore, of Buddhism itself. At the stage in the history of my going for refuge, which we have now reached, the stage represented by a survey of Buddhism, I did not, however, realize the absolute centrality of the act of going for refuge, or rather, though I realized it in principle to some extent, I had not yet worked out its implications, which were in fact very far-reaching indeed. If the new index to the sixth edition of the survey can be relied on, if the body of the work, as distinct from the introduction, which was added later, the three jewels are mentioned as a triad three times, and the three refuges once, while going for refuge is mentioned six times. Interestingly enough, the most extended treatment of the subject is to be found in Chapter 4, The Bodhisattva Ideal. In the section dealing with the preliminary devotional practices undertaken by the would-be bodhisattva. These preliminary devotional practices are collectively known as supreme worship, Anuttara Puja, or, as we generally say in the FWBO, the Sevenfold Puja. The third practice, or the second if one follows Shantideva in conflating the first and second practices and counting six altogether instead of seven, being that of going for refuge, Saranagamana. The key passage in the two pages dealing with going for refuge as one of the preliminary devotional practices occurs at the very beginning and reads as follows. Going for refuge, Saranagamana, means, of course, going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. While even a non-Buddhist can, in a sense, respect and honour the Triple Gem, to take refuge in them is the prerogative of the professing and practicing Buddhist alone. Formal refuge, which is held to constitute one a member of the Buddhist community, can be taken simply by repeating after any ordained monk the refuge formula and the five precepts. But effective refuge, of which the formal refuge is at once the expression and the symbol, can be taken only by one who has an understanding of the true nature of the Triple Gem. The deeper this understanding goes, the more effective will be his refuge. Taking refuge in the Triple Gem is not, therefore, an act to be done once and for all time, but something which grows with one's understanding of Buddhism. The refuge is complete when one's understanding of Buddhism is complete, that is to say, when one attains enlightenment. Then, paradoxically enough, there is no going for refuge. The enlightened one is his own refuge. End of quote. I then go on to discuss the minimum degree of understanding needed for taking effective refuge in the three jewels. And in this connection, point out that inasmuch as the Mahayana has a deeper understanding of the Triple Gem than the Hinayana, the significance which it attaches to the act of taking refuge is naturally more profound. Nevertheless, I'm at pains to make it clear that, doctrinal differences notwithstanding, all schools of Buddhism, whether of the great or little vehicle, agree in recognizing the decisive importance in the Buddhist life of the act of taking refuge. A statement which to some extent anticipates my present general position. In the key passage itself, I distinguish between formal refuge and effective refuge, in much the same way that I was later to distinguish between provisional or ethnic refuge and between effective refuge and real refuge. More important still, I insist that taking refuge in the Triple Gem is not an act to be done once and for all time, but something that grows with one's understanding of Buddhism. An insight that made the development of my thinking about Buddhism possible and which underlies much of my current thinking. Except that I would now add that one's understanding of Buddhism grows as one's going for refuge becomes more effective and more real. Yet, despite such anticipations and semi-anticipations, the key passage in my discussion of going for refuge, considered as one of the preliminary devotional practices undertaken by the would-be bodhisattva, cannot really be regarded as foreshadowing either the deeper understanding of the significance of the act of going for refuge, at which I eventually arrived, or my realization of the implications of that act, properly understood, for the whole theory and practice of Buddhism. I am not referring to the comparatively unimportant fact that, speaking of formal refuge in the Triple Gem, I say that it can be taken simply by repeating after any ordained monk the refuge formula and the five precepts. This statement is in any case modified towards the end of my discussion of going for refuge as one of the preliminary devotional practices of the would-be bodhisattva, where I say that the refuges are generally taken from a bhikshu, and that in the absence of a bhikshu, a Buddhist assembly may be led in the taking of the three refuges by any senior lay devotee. Though even this does not go nearly far enough and begs all sorts of questions. In insisting that the key passage in the survey's most extended treatment of going for refuge cannot really be regarded as foreshadowing my later views on the subject, I am referring to something much more subtle and profound. Though in the purely formal or abstract sense, my understanding of the meaning of going for refuge was not incorrect, and though I even realized in principle to some extent the absolute centrality of the act of going for refuge, I did not actually place that act, as I then understood it, at the very heart and center of Buddhism, with all the momentous consequences that would have then followed. I did not accord it that absolute priority over all other acts, which, by its very nature, it demands. At the beginning of the key passage already quoted, after defining going for refuge as going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, I continue. While even a non-Buddhist can, in a sense, respect and honor the Triple Gem, to take refuge in them is the prerogative of the professing and practicing Buddhist alone. This is really to put the cart before the horse, for, as I observed in section 4, in connection with my going forth, one does not go for refuge because one is a Buddhist, but is a Buddhist because one goes for refuge. Similarly, going for refuge is not simply one of the preliminary devotional practices which one undertakes in order to develop the bodhicitta, or will to enlightenment, thus becoming a bodhisattva. It is because one goes for refuge that one is a bodhisattva. As I came to realize only at a subsequent stage in the history of my going for refuge, the bodhisattva's aspiration to attain supreme enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings is in fact the altruistic dimension of the act of going for refuge itself, which by its very nature cannot be regarded as having implications for oneself alone. Provisional going for refuge can, of course, be regarded as a means to the arising of the real bodhicitta. But equally, the provisional bodhicitta can be regarded as a means to real going for refuge. We must be careful not to make the mistake of thinking that what is, in fact, only a revised version of a certain stage of spiritual development is actually a higher stage. The Mahayana came to see the real bodhicitta as superior to the provisional going for refuge, for much the same reason that it came to see the bodhisattva ideal as superior to the arahant ideal, i.e., because in the hands of the Hinayana, the concept of going for refuge had lost much of its original significance. So that a fresh formulation of what it had been intended to convey had to be found. Earlier on in Chapter 4, The Bodhisattva Ideal, in the section entitled The Unifying Factor, I describe the Bodhisattva Ideal as the principal unifying factor, not only for the Mahayana schools, but for the entire Buddhist tradition. But inasmuch as the Bodhisattva is one in whom the bodhicitta has arisen, and inasmuch as the arising of the bodhicitta is the altruistic dimension of going for refuge, it is in fact the act of going for refuge that is the principal unifying factor in Buddhism. What I say about the Bodhisattva ideal in chapter 4 of the survey has to be read, where necessary, in the light of this realization. In much the same way, those passages in chapters 1 to 3 of the survey, which intend to identify the Sangha or spiritual community with the monastic order, must be read in the light of the realization that, as I have explained in section 5 of this paper, becoming a monk is of significance and value only to the extent that it is an expression of one's going for refuge. Indeed, in chapter 2 of the survey, Hinayana and Mahayana, in the section entitled What is Mahayana Buddhism? Having commented on the Mahayana bhikshu's healthier and more truly orthodox attitude to the formal aspects of monasticism, I not only point out that, once it has been admitted that a bodhisattva may be either a monk or a layman, it becomes impossible to identify the spiritual life exclusively with a life of monasticism, but also make it clear that the Buddha himself did not identify commitment to the spiritual life with adoption of the monastic lifestyle by quoting Dhammapada verse 142 to this effect. In this connection, I have one more point to make before concluding this section. In various parts of the survey, but particularly in chapter 2, section 4, Factors in the Emergence of the Mahayana, I severely criticize the Hinayana in general and the Theravada Sangha, i.e. the Theravada monastic order, in particular, for what I term over-attachment to the merely formal aspects of monasticism, which I in fact enumerate as one of the five factors which were responsible on the negative side for the emergence of the Mahayana as a historical phenomenon. Rereading my strictures 21 years later, I found them milder than I had thought, and, though severe enough, fully justified, and therefore wrote in the preface to the 5th 1980 edition of the survey, "In the light of subsequent experience, I am convinced that my criticisms of the modern Theravada were, and still are, not only fully justified, but absolutely necessary, and I do not retract a word of what I wrote. I would only like to add that, far from being confined to the modern Theravada, the canker of formalism can sometimes be found in other forms of Buddhism too, not least in contemporary Zen." End of quote. 10 years further on, I would like to add that although my criticisms of the Theravada were harsh, as one of my friends called them, and although that harshness was fully justified, they were in reality not harsh enough, in the sense that they were not sufficiently radical. Though I speak in unfavorable terms of that identification of the religious life exclusively with the formal aspects of monasticism, which is so prominent a feature of the Hinayana, I do so only incidentally, and in giving my various colorful examples of formalism and hypocrisy within the modern Theravada, monastic, Sangha, do not sufficiently bring out the fact that what is really wrong with it is its confusion of going for refuge with becoming a monk, commitment with lifestyle. Members of the Theravada, monastic, Sangha, are not so much bad monks as bad Buddhists. Indeed, it is possible to be a good monk in the formalistic sense and at the same time a bad Buddhist. One might even go so far as to say that it is possible to be a bad monk and a good Buddhist. If one bears this in mind, and bears in mind that the arising of the bodhicitta, or will to enlightenment, represents the altruistic dimension of going for refuge, one will have gone a long way towards placing the act of going for refuge at the very heart and center of Buddhism, and a long way, therefore, towards seeing the extent to which my later thinking about Buddhism is implicit in my earlier thinking.